This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. Nice to be here a second weekend in the city. I really like it here. We did the Ango art presentations this week, both at the monastery and here at the temple. So I have been thinking about the creative process and the Buddha Dharma. And yesterday I was walking down State Street and somebody had a blanket out, and I always like to see what people are reading, you know, what books they put out and about their life on that blanket. And there was a big book of Robert Frost's poetry. And not that I always go to Robert Frost, but for some reason I picked up Robert Frost's big book of poetry. And he was speaking about what a good poem does and the way it does it. It was like in the first part. And it said, a good poem is a fresh look and a fresh listen. Read it 100 times. It will forever keep its freshness as metal keeps its fragrance. And then he wrote a little further down, you're not trying to tell a person say something they didn't already know, but give them the shock of recognition. And I thought that's very much like the Dharma too. To encounter something fresh and alive, and this shock of recognition. We're shocked into recognizing ourselves. So that's what I'm going to attempt to share with you today, is something around what we just heard in the intro to the talk. The Dharma is dark to the mind, but radiant to the heart. So something is being communicated in art, in Dharma, intimately. We can feel it. And if we can leap out of our fixed view, be shocked into recognizing something that we're familiar with and it becomes unfamiliar again, something radiates. And what is that radiance in our heart that we can find in situations where we can't go to our mind to resolve it, but it's dark to our mind, but we feel it. It's radiant to our heart. Because our mind isn't, as we know, always the best thing to go to. It doesn't always have the best answers, good answers, and it's sometimes stuck in perceptions and views that are very harmful, debilitating, sometimes freeing, but not always the best. Now, I was asked the other day, how did you find Buddhism? And that's always to me like, oh my God, like, where do I start, you know, for any of you? Because it's sometimes such a confluence, right, of so many, like even those of you that came in today, like, what made you wake up and come to a temple in Brooklyn, you know, to sit, to learn meditation, to encounter the Buddha's Dharma. That's what we speak of as the Buddha Dharma. And one aspect of that was a tea bowl. Now, we all know what a tea bowl is, but a tea bowl, that what became so unfamiliar. It was so deeply centered and off and asymmetrical that it was timeless, and it just went right into my heart when I encountered it. Something happened that my head couldn't wrap around. And this happens often as we encounter works of art or even the teachings of the Buddha. We feel it, we hear it, we see it, we feel it. It's how I felt with some of the brush paintings that were very spontaneous and immediate, and some of the sounds of some of the instruments. And when we engage the work, it changes our habitual way of seeing. The effect endures beyond the time that it was made or that we encounter it. It keeps going, keeps on giving. So the Buddha, Dharma, and art puts us into the shock of recognition again and again. We're turned to meet our essential nature, our Buddha nature, the boundless creativity of the universe. That's that heart part. The bowl that I held was made by Rengetsu, and she's the 49th woman ancestor that we chanted. And her life was one of, in the Pure Land Buddhism, and pottery. She'd lost a stepfather, a stepmother, a husband, and four children in a short period of time. And so her grief was worked into her clay, into her experience of working on the wheel, so that she could fathom and tolerate and be with herself in what was she couldn't figure out, that was dark to her mind. So she can find that radiance of being alive in her heart and that thing that we all share. Aristotle wrote that poetic language should appear strange and wonderful, and it often does. It strikes us unexpectedly that we see anew and hear afresh. And I was reading a piece about the art of novels and the novelist scholar David Lodge. I never heard of him. He asked, what do we mean when we say that a book is original? And the quote is, it's not unusual that a writer has invented something without precedent, but have they made us perceive what we already, in a conceptual sense, know by deviating from the conventional habitual ways of representing reality? Now, I often tell students when we work in art practice, you can't help but be original. I mean, there's not two of you. I mean, nobody has your nervous system. Nobody has your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, your body, your mind. So just enter with that, find the trust in your mark, in your sound, fully. Don't try to make something new, just be true. And then there was this this essay, which some of you may know, I was reading about, by a Russian literary theorist, Viktor Skolovsky. And he called this thing he wrote about defamiliarization. He wrote, the purpose of art is to impart the sensation of things as they are perceived and not as they are known. To accomplish this, art makes objects unfamiliar. So interesting. And I saw that in the art practice. To these degrees, people could. Things that were familiar were made unfamiliar again in each person's way. Now, last week I gave a talk, if you were here, on, here's an example of, he continues, thus, defamiliarization serves as a means to implore individuals to recognize artistic language, which is difficult to understand. So, for example, last week I presented my heavy metal auntie, Iron Grindstone Lou, in a koan, meeting her teacher, Guishan. And it went like this. Iron Grindstone Lu went to Master Guishan Ling Yu. Guishan said, old cow, so you've come. And the grinder said, tomorrow on Mount Wutai, there's a big gathering and feast. Are you going, teacher? And Guishan laid down, he sprawled out, and she turned around and left immediately. That's all we have. Okay? So this is 9th century in China. Mount Wutai is 600 miles away. So she's questioning him, are you going to the feast at Mount Wutai tomorrow? 600 miles away in 9th century China, how's he going to get there? Like, we don't have what we have now. So what on earth do we make of this? We're reading this, these words, and they're going in. Have they communicated something in some way what's hidden to the normal mind? So this is the point of a koan, is if we go to the normal way, we won't get to the feast. We won't get to the mountain. We won't get to meet ourselves. So our concepts of space and time have to collapse. And we have to enter this in a new way. We have to radiate our heart. We have to let go of where the mind wants to set things up, the figuring out. And just like he demonstrated, he rested right in there. He just turned around and lied down. He just demonstrated it. Sokolovsky goes on to say, habituation devours work, clothes, furniture, one's wife, and the fear of war. And art exists that one may recover the sensation of life. It exists to make one feel things, to make the stone stony. I like that line. To make the stone stony. So Zazen is the bedrock of opening the space to us of who we are. We can see with each breath that arises and loosen our grip to all those perceptions and ideas that keep coming through and talking to us. So we can just keep starting anew, release. Come back to that openness, that open spaciousness. Have the world, in a sense, become unfamiliar and wondrous again and again and again. I remember my first year at the monastery, I was the cook. And basically, we didn't have a lot like we have now. It wasn't like teff, amaranth. You know, we have all these cereals now. It was either like cream of wheat or oatmeal. And he asked me, like, Hoj, how do you make the oatmeal fresh every day? And it was, you know, this is from my teacher. So he's not just asking me an idle question. How do you make the oatmeal fresh every day? I worked on that for about 6 years. So he was writing this, Sokolovsky was writing at a time when modern art of the early 20th century, like 1920s, was hard to understand and was intended to upset conventional expectations, which is integral to longevity. You know, I love James Baldwin's writings on art. And you can read it. I'll just give you a small line from him. He said, artists are here to disturb the peace. Otherwise we would have chaos. Isn't that great? It takes a while to find true peace in things being disturbed. So not settling down for platitudes or perceptions, getting fixed. I call it hardening of our categories, like the hardening of our categories. It's an illness. I think we long for a more direct, immediate experience of the world. Even as we strive to understand things, somehow at the same time we yearn to release, to let go of all our understanding, all our knowing, and let it radiate our heart so we can meet things intimately and fresh. Think of yourself if you go to board meetings. I mean, a lot of us have these meetings where You could just feel like head, heart, head, heart, head, heart. Which one do we go through? You know, do we care about the people in the room or are we on the agenda? Can we be on the agenda and care for the heart at the same time? That would be new. That would be novel. And so I thought of this piece I read a while ago, and I still had it. I went for it. I don't have the book anymore. It's Proust was a neuroscientist. I don't usually read books like this, but it had a lot of artists in it. One was Cézanne and the way he saw Saul. And this one was about Igor Stravinsky and the Rite of Spring, because I had just seen Pina Bausch's presentation of the Rite of Spring, where if you know the story, he opens this, so the Rite of Spring, Stravinsky opens the second set, this is written in here, I'll paraphrase, with his work, with a monstrous migraine of sound. Though the music had just started, Stravinsky is already relishing the total rejection of our expectations. And what happened was the bourgeois, like, there was a riot in the theater. The bourgeois was expecting something more like Chopin, and here comes all this discordant stuff, and they're like, what? Right? The audience at the premiere began to scream. The right had started a riot. Old ladies attacked music students. Insults were hurled at ballerinas. The riot got so loud that the orchestra conductor could no longer hear what he was conducting, and the orchestra disintegrated into a cacophony of confused instruments. And why? And then he asks, why did the crowd riot that night? How could a piece of music move a crowd to violence? This was the right secret. For the audience, Stravinsky's new work was the sound of remorseless originality. The crowd was expecting more Chopin, and what they got instead was the gory birth of modern music. Stravinsky created this effect by conceding nothing to the audience. He disfigured its traditions and dismantled its illusions. The harmonies we worship and the tonic chords we trust are not sacred. Nothing is sacred. Nature is noise. Music is nothing but a sliver of sound that we have learned to hear. With the right, Stravinsky announced that it was time to learn something new. This faith in our mind's plasticity, our ability to adapt to new kinds of musics, was Stravinsky's enduring insight. And he said when he was first working on this, reminds me of here, like you hear, I hear a guy playing saxophone on the roof all the time, and then somebody else is a cello. It's great. It's like I open the window and there's this whole cacophony happening. He said a young neighborhood boy got into the habit of yelling, "That's wrong," every time he was practicing. He knew the brain would eventually right this wrongness. The audience would adapt to his difficult notes and discover the beauty locked inside his art. Nothing is difficult forever. Anyway, you see what I got here. But just one more piece here. Because the sound is new, Stravinsky electrified the familiar. Never before in the history of music had a composer dared to confront us with this particular shiver of compressed air, played with this kind of naked staccato. The brain is befuddled, its cells baffled. We have no idea what the sound is or where it might go or what note will come next. We feel the tension, but we can't imagine the release. This is this great shock, and the Dharma can do this to us. Buddha did it constantly, and I'll bring up some examples. For generations in different forms of teaching, that's what's been passed on, to skillfully work with practitioners to undermine our certainties, our fixed views. So, for example, this is the Buddha's second discourse where he takes apart the five aggregates, our skandhas, our parts, our feeling, form, perception, concepts, and consciousness. And he takes that apart through the lens of the three marks of existence: impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and no self. So this is pretty new. So you have the language is, you got to listen to it. How do you think of this, O monks? How do you think of this, O Sangha? Is form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, O Lord. Now that which is impermanent, is it unsatisfactory or satisfactory? Unsatisfactory, Lord. Now that which is impermanent, unsatisfactory, subject to change, is it proper to regard that as this is mind, this I am, this is myself? Indeed, not that, O Lord. So he rocks our perception. He takes away, you know, feeling as self, perception as self, concepts as self, consciousness as self. He rocks the perceptions about the nature of our experience into the uncertain nature of it all. Form is neither permanent, satisfactory, or endowed with self-existence. None of those. And of course, no self was and continues to be one of Buddha's revolutionary insights. Doesn't mean we're not here, you're not there, but it may not be what we think as a fixed, permanent, non-moving self, individual thing. Anatta, anatman, no self. And what was popular was the Hindu belief, Atman, an inner self or a soul. He saw fresh and new and past the shocking newness, offering us a more liberative way of seeing to be directly experienced. And that shock continues today, right? We think we are permanent, maybe not so much, but we're not. We mix up going after our craving, thinking that'll make us happy. In the long run, they don't. One after another, Buddha's teachings challenge our established views, our version of the world and our constructs, our mental constructs. And he implores us, as many teachers do, let the shock startle you. Let us help you let go of the grasp into suchness, into this directness right here, wide open and fresh. So I found this poem too by Emily Dickinson, where I love in it, it took me a while, but she dissects her own perception within it. And it goes like this. Like rain, it sounded till it curved, and then I knew 'twas wind. It walked as wet as any wave, but swept as dry as sand. When it had pushed itself away to some remotest plain, a coming us of hosts was heard. That was indeed the rain. So it sounded to her like rain. It was rain, but it was the wind. And then after the wind went by, the rain came. So she's calling herself out on, like, I thought the wind was rain, but it was the wind. And then the rain came. So it all came. So it was a very fresh look and a fresh listen to what is familiar and the way things happen. She was very willing in most of her poems to let us feel how magical living and things were. How shifting, how an incredible, miraculous display of light and familiar things and making them unfamiliar. And Aristotle wrote, we may look at a real beetle and find it really disgusting. Like, how many of us look at a beetle and go like, ah! But then if we see it drawn perfectly, we can really look at it. We can really appreciate it. It fascinates us. And we can be shocked by it. First, the other one's a different kind of shock, right? I remember Pat Steer's paintings. She used to draw a pear, like you could pluck it, same size, like you can pluck it right off the canvas. That's how real it was. And then she'd put a big old drippy X across it. This is a painting of a pear. She did that a lot. Don't mistake that this is a pear. You just said this is a pear, and then poof. It's not a pear, it's paint. She told me that too. So we chanted this morning the Heart Sutra, Mahaprajnaparamita Heart Sutra, shorter condensation of a longer Prajnaparamita Sutra, Wisdom Sutra. And we see in that, in our Heart Sutra, how Buddha takes everything we thought we knew, our fixed perceptions, and gives us a big nudge over the cliff. As we are turned on our heads to see fresh and direct. So we have to allow the teachings to work us. Dark to the mind, radiant to the heart, takes some mulching. Because our mind goes to things so quickly and wraps it all up in its little package and we're done. But the heart is mulching. The heart, through the heart, takes time and takes, we have to be with things. We have to be with ourself. It has to work on us. The Dharma has to work on us. So here's the setup, right? Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva is doing deep Prajnaparamita. So this Bodhisattva of compassion is sitting in deep wisdom before she knows anything, like us, before we know. It happens. The moment, if we sit down and be our breath, we're coursing in deep Prajnaparamita, to whatever deep is deep. Deep is just doing it. That's deep. That's pretty deep. That's really deep. We think we're not sitting deep. If you're sitting, that's deep. If you're encountering your breath completely, that's pretty damn deep. Look at this world. Look at this world. To sit down and be with yourself like that? Wow. I think so. So what did Avalokiteshvara see? Even though she's not separate, which is Prajna wisdom, that we're not separate, she clearly saw something. Clearly saw the emptiness of the five conditions of our eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, form, perception, conception. She saw there's nothing to hold on to there. It's fresh, moment to moment to moment to moment. So we come upon this word shunyata, translated as emptiness. It sounds like, a trash can with nothing in it, like a vacancy, a loss. And Thich Nhat Hanh, writing on the Heart Sutra, said, it's not emptiness, it's fullness. It's interdependence, a quality where there's nothing separate. Empty means empty of a separate self. That was Thich Nhat Hanh. And the etymology of the word sunya refers to that looks like a lot, but it's really nothing. That's what it's translated. That looks like a lot, but it's really nothing. If we can just remember that when we're so tied up in knots. That looks like a lot, but it's really nothing. Don't ignore it, but just about everything we see looks like a lot, but it's really nothing. Nothing. And scholars began to translate shunyata using the word empty to emphasize empty of own being, not being separate from others or anything. That is a real experience. The Heart Sutra is a real experience. One teacher said, if you can just realize the Heart Sutra, turn in your cushion. That's all of Buddhism in that one sutra. That's it. That's all you gotta realize. We're working it, aren't we? Yeah. So if we scientifically, science is right along with this, if it focuses on all our parts and goes deep in, then all we end up with at the end is frequencies. Electrical energies interacting. Molecules, energies interacting. Take away all the concepts, the clothing we have on, the ideas of who we are. What do we see? The magnificence of electrical energy interacting. Vibrations. But you see how what we've become, you know, what our mind is working with, it's big, right? We know this. And the dharanis we chant, like the Shosaimyo, that is a dharani. When you chant that, that's a healing dharani. So it creates frequencies, molecules in your body to heal you. And that goes outward to those on the list that are in need of it. So that's why we always say, put yourself into the chanting, because it's for you. It's like, you got to, I can't do that to you. You can't, nobody can do it for you, put that freshness in. So when we chant, it's up to us to heal ourselves with that chant. One teacher wrote on emptiness, free of all concepts and ideas about a thing. All our ideas about something, all our names for something, aren't true, but we do need to communicate. Things are just as they are. Don't be confused. And in our relationships, we say we know what the other person is, know what they're all about. We have their signs, their data, and we can predict their behavior. But can we really allow for not knowing? Be surprised by those so close to us. Have them be unfamiliar. Like this week, I'm with Anastasia and Laura and Kian. Every day, we wake up, we sit, we eat breakfast, we go through the day. But it surprises me every moment their creatureness. It's fantastic. They're unfamiliar moment to moment to moment. And I could feel the difference. I know when I do that to people, when I box them in, make them seem familiar, don't budge. We change moment to moment. That's what gives us, if we didn't, I don't know, I'm out of here, sort of. What's the point? What's the point? So the five conditions are a way for us to communicate how it is we react moment to moment, how we are constantly shifting and changing qualities and create different sets of vibrations of who we are. It's not just that these things change, but the way we view them changes. And that's our liberation. That's our liberation. Liberating the views. By not holding two fixed views, the pure-hearted one having clarity of vision is not born again into this world. You are the pure-hearted one. By not holding two fixed views in the Karaniya Metta Sutra, the pure-hearted one, we're all pure-hearted ones, having clarity, but we're born again and again because we do that. We have self everywhere, you know, a misunderstanding in a way. So we have to open to the language, sound, art, poetry, music, the course of changing our brain. And so a few sutras came up I'll share with you, and you can explore them, where our familiar notions are, for me, stretched. I mean, go to the Avatamsaka Sutra. You got to enter that world. I'm not going to bring that one in. But there's worlds within worlds within worlds within worlds within worlds within worlds, and you got, and there's all kinds of living beings in all these different places. So this is from the Vimalakirti Sutra. If Vimalakirti was a lay teacher, and he's ill, he's sick. And so thousands of bodhisattvas, brahmins, devas, nagas, yakshas, arhats, mythical and divine beings congregate into his living room. Thousands, okay? Picture your living room, okay? Now it's filled. So you got to stretch a bit there, you know? It's saying they're all in his living room. And he's not feeling well. He's sick. And then 500 more youths from a nearby town come with parasols, jeweled parasols, and set them down before the Buddha, who's also in the house. All are there. This is from the Thurman. All are there, and parasols have been laid down. Suddenly, the miraculous power of the Lord Buddha, they were transformed into a single precious canopy, so great that it formed a covering of this entire billion-world galaxy. It's like Star Wars here. The surface of the entire billion-world galaxy is reflected in the interior of the great precious canopy, where the total content of the galaxy could be seen. Limitless mansions of suns, moons, and stellar bodies, the realms of devas, nagas, and yakshas, all the great oceans, rivers, bays, torrent streams, brooks, and springs, finally the villages, suburbs, cities, capitals, provinces, wildernesses, all this can be clearly seen by everyone. Is this not true? The point being that everything, everywhere is miraculously visible. And what kind of effect can that have when we enter it into our deepest questions of who are we? Who are you? Who am I? When I think that large, if we allow our hearts to radiate without knowing completely. And being unfamiliar, we can feel disassembled, disrupted, dismantled, but we're expanded from the normal way we think and understand time and space, everyone, everything. Vimalakirti offers this teaching. Insofar as apparent objects are perceived, they are the basis of sickness. What things are perceived as objects? What is the thorough understanding of the basic apparent object? It is non-perception, as not objects exist ultimately. We're expanded and brought back to form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness, exactly form. Perception is exactly non-perception. Not understanding this is the source of why we're sick. That's the sickness. Yet Vimalakirti himself is sick, which is why everyone is there in his living room for the first place. But what is he sickness with? What is he sick with? He's sick with the sickness of all beings. And what is their sickness? What is our sickness? There is no sickness. There is no sickness. Creation is full of mystery. We will never entirely understand it. We shouldn't be so arrogant and be really humble and stand in awe of our earth, of each other, of everything. We must recover the sense of the majesty of creation and the ability to be worshipful in its presence. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. The monastery's quarterly journal, Mountain Record, has a new home at mountainrecord.org. For over 30 years, Mountain Record has been offering spiritual seekers of all faiths a unique journey through words and images. Each quarterly issue delivers a thought-provoking array of classic teachings, contemporary wisdom, stunning photographs, and news from the Mountains and Rivers Order. For more information, to subscribe, or to read our open access articles, visit mountainrecord.org.